contact tracers than before.
So that's Media Bear. Seems to be producing quite a lot of interesting tunes over in the US. Welcome back to CFM's politics show. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. This week, the Christchurch mosque massacre shooter sentenced in New Zealand, but at his trial, nothing whatever about evidence that he had a lot of help in the operation. Evidence there in the sick video that he took of the killing, streamed live on Facebook. So, is this the end of the matter? Protests in the US also, and Trump accepting the Republican nomination. We'll be hearing from Trump in a minute, as we did from Biden last week. And great news about the polio being eliminated in Africa. But what the BBC didn't tell you is the vaccine strain of polio is killing and maiming thousands of people who probably wouldn't have been afflicted if they hadn't been vaccinated. Also on 5G here in Bristol, we heard protests last week about a 5G mast going up in St. Paul's. Freya Lockwood is employed by Bristol City Council as a lobbyist for 5G in the city as part of Bristol Smart Cities. She used to work at a company called Kinetic, which is a privatised version of the research arm of the British military. Freya Lockwood, what are you doing exactly? She doesn't respond to any of my requests for interviews, even though she's a public servant, supposedly. Anyway, she says it's all safe, this 5G. Is she lying? Dr. Deborah Davis from the Environmental Health Trust will be hearing from her, talking about how mobile phones definitely do cause cancer. And a former Bank of England staffer turned scholar of the central banking cult by what he saw inside the Bank of England. His name is Mohammed Rafiq. I interviewed him for this show back in 2012, but he's passed away last week. We go back to look at his pearls of wisdom and what's really wrong with the banking system from an insider, a former insider. And we've heard of ISIS and the medieval cult of the assassins, a neo-Islamic satanic cult designed to discredit the faith, and the Christian Zionists and history's medieval Knights Templar, the world's first international bankers fulfilling the same sort of role, attaching themselves to the Christian faith. But what about the Kabbalists, the Jewish so-called mysticism? For you realise that Judaism is governed by two competing books of guidance, the Talmuds, one Jerusalem Talmud and the other a Babylonian Talmud. And that's where the ancient Kabbalah is thought to come from, the second of the two. We hear from one of the world's scholars and authors on the topic, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. His name is David Livingston, the guy that we always seem to have problems with WhatsApp, Facebook and Skype when we're trying to interview him. So we ask him, and I hear from him today, what are the true origins of the Kabbalistic Judaism, what many people call a fake version of the faith. But Martin, first of all, we hear this week great news that Donald Trump has accepted the nomination for president. Is this really theatre, this election race? And can Trump possibly lose against Biden?
Well, it's it could go either way. I mean, if you look at the opinion polls, either of them could win.
But Biden is not really a great personality in front of the camera. He's extremely elderly, and apparently he can't really function at all without an auto cue to read from.
Well, that's why he's chosen Kamala Harris to run the country if he wins. And Trump's got lots of solid supporters who are going to vote for him whatever he does. He assassinated Soleimani at the beginning of the year, which nearly turned into World War III. Luckily, it didn't, but it might have done, and people might decide, but actually, we can't afford another 4 years of Trump. So Biden, it has to be, because the first-past-the-post system, as rubbish in the United States as it is here, means that third parties can't get a look in. So it's one or t'other, and that's what they're left with.
Okay, so anyway, let's have a listen now, as we did last week, to Biden, to a bit of Donald Trump and his acceptance speech for the Republican nomination for November's U.S. presidential elections to run the... Actually, no, before we hear that, Martin, does the president really run the Anglo-Zionist empire?
No, as Putin pointed out years ago, I've spoken to four different presidents, and it's quite clear that they don't make the policy.
Biden voted for the NAFTA disaster, the single worst trade deal ever enacted. He supported China's entry into the World Trade Organization, one of the greatest economic disasters of all time. After those Biden calamities, the United States lost 1 in 4 manufacturing jobs. We laid off workers in Michigan, Ohio, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and many other states, they didn't want to hear Biden's hollow words of empathy. They wanted their jobs back. As vice president, he supported the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have been a death sentence for the U.S. auto industry. He backed the horrendous South Korea trade deal, which took many jobs from our country and which I've reversed and made a great deal for our country. He repeatedly supported mass amnesty for illegal immigrants. He voted for the Iraq War. He opposed the mission to take out Osama bin Laden. He opposed killing Soleimani. He oversaw the rise of ISIS and cheered the rise of China as a positive development for America and the world, some positive development. That's why China supports Joe Biden and desperately wants him to win. I can tell you that upon very good information. China would own our country if Joe Biden got elected. Unlike Biden, I will hold them fully accountable for the tragedy that they caused all over the world. They caused. In recent months, our nation and the world has been hit by the once-in-a-century pandemic that China allowed to spread around the globe. They could have stopped it, but they allowed it to come out. We are grateful to be joined tonight by several of our incredible nurses and first responders. Please stand and accept our profound thanks and gratitude.
I suppose that's a great way to end your presidential speech, Martin, isn't it? Talking about how the first responders, but he's doing everything he possibly can to pin up Biden as basically he's working for the Chinese.
Yeah, Biden basically is in the pocket of Wall Street, and so is Donald Trump. And they're both claiming that the other side is in the pocket of the Chinese, which is pretty ridiculous in the circumstances. The Wall Street has allowed Trump talking there about losing jobs to China. During his presidency, they've lost more jobs than ever to China. So all this stuff about how it's basically to do with what's called the Triffin dilemma. If you're going to have a world currency as your currency is the world's reserve currency, you've got to have trade deficits. It's just economically logical. And if you don't want to have trade deficits, then you've got to stop the dollar being the world's reserve currency, which means that you've got to end the American empire, which means you've got to bring all your bases back. I mean, a lot of the trade deficit in the US is they spend all the money having 180 bases around the world. If they brought them all home, then they'd have a lot more money to spend at home. But unfortunately, they don't want to do that. And of course, that's going to carry on whoever the president is, because that Triffin dilemma hasn't gone away, and it won't go away until Wall Street collapses and the US is defeated.
I mean, looking at antiwar.com this week, the headlines at the moment, looking at particularly at tensions with China, which Trump seems to be pushing, Biden the opposite, they're saying both Taiwan is extremely nervous. The Philippines are saying if China attacks our navy, we'll call the US. Pompeo, the Secretary of State, is moaning about China fishing near the Galapagos Islands. He's saying it's deeply troubling. It does seem as if this is all... China is a long way from the United States, and actually what's going to happen if they... relations do collapse between the two, as they're beginning to do, particularly as Pompeo seems to want them to do, is countries like Taiwan and the Philippines are going to be the ones in the crosshairs.
They are, yeah. And of course, the Chinese see these things rather differently. I mean, a lot of this stuff is their neighbourhood. I mean, if the Chinese Navy was carrying out exercises off the coast of Los Angeles the way that the Americans seem to want to do off the coast of China, then Trump would have something to complain about. But, of course, they're not, and they don't. And, in fact, the only way forward for everybody is to cooperate to try and prevent World War III. And, of course, this kind of political rhetoric in the United States, and both sides are doing it, Biden's claiming that Trump's soft on China. You know, there's no common sense there. I mean, the only thing that will make them understand that they can't talk like that is if the Chinese sink a couple of their aircraft carriers and say, what are you going to do about it?
Well, of course, I know what they'd do about it is they would sink our, there would be potentially a third world war would start, Martin.
That's right. Well, no, because you wouldn't.
You're saying that's the only option?
No, I'm just saying that this kind of political rhetoric in the US, the Chinese roll their eyes. Yeah. They've forgotten about the Korean War, where they were fought to a standstill.
I mean, it does seem that they take a mature attitude in trying to take a step back from all of this, mm-hmm. and allowing the Americans basically to make blunders. I mean, we've seen over the last week, haven't we, with the visit of the chief of the International Atomic Energy Authority to Tehran. They've agreed apparently a couple of inspections of sites, nuclear inspections. There's also the attempt by Pompeo, a rather cack-handed one, ham-fisted attempt, in order to try and invoke certain clauses in the joint JCPOA. We mentioned that last week, which were completely, you know, they're not even in this the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. They left it 2 or 3 years ago, and yet they're still trying to invoke clauses from a deal they're not even in.
Yeah, they're not signatories to the law of the sea either, but they're trying to enforce it in the South China Sea, even though they won't sign up to it themselves. They're not members of the International Criminal Court because they don't want their generals to stand trial.
There's definitely a lawless streak in the US, isn't there? They're not interested in international law, really, are they?
Well, they are, as long as they're the ones making the laws and everybody else has got to obey them. And, of course, that's regarded as normal in US politics, sadly. Anybody who talks any common sense about it is shouted down as not being sufficiently pro-American enough. But, of course, the rest of the planet has to put up with their arrogant behaviour, frankly. And we don't get any vote in this at all. But they decide what's going to happen, and the rest of us have to suck it up.
And also, they get to land their B-52s down the road from here whenever they feel like it.
Well, indeed. And as I've said before...
And making us, maybe, by the way, making Gloucestershire a target for a potential nuclear attack.
And that's why they're not allowed to do it in France, and they're not allowed to do it in other in Switzerland, for example. Why is Britain just allowing the US to use our land in that way? And that's because we've always done it.
It's the unsinkable aircraft carrier.
Well, indeed. But, I mean, but ultimately, they're reaching a point now where the Germans, for example, are defying them to build the Nord Stream 2 pipeline with the Russians. And ultimately, the Americans should go home. There's no reason for the Europe at all.
You know, when these B-52s arrive, I'm reminded of Duncan Campbell's work. He was an investigative journalist and mainly working in the 1980s. He did the Secret Society series for the BBC under Alistair Milne, which was one of the things that annoyed the Thatcher government so much that they put John Burt in charge of the BBC, got rid of the Director General. Certainly as important work was his, but he did a book called The Unsinkable Aircraft Carrier in the 80s, all about American military power in Britain. But he also did one which was, in a way, more disturbing, which was called War Plan UK, which was it's basically a NATO plan saying that if there was any kind of, you know, serious war, like a, you know, international conflict, that much of the UK regional command centres, etc., would be taken over by US military. Here in Britain, just deciding you're going to move this way and basically telling our military what to do.
Yeah, well, the same's true in Germany, of course.
And our population.
The same's true in Germany. And, of course, Trump is threatening the Germans that he's going to take his troops out of Germany. And quite a lot of people on the left in Germany are saying, well, good riddance, go away. The Poles are then saying, well, bring them here, we want them. The right-wing government in Poland are actually promising that they will pay taxes to have the US based in Poland. All of which is to do with people's perceived threat from Russia, etc. I think the situation is actually incredibly fragile. And, you know, election campaigns where people are banging the drum like Trump for confrontation are really not helpful.
Well, I can tell you what, Pompeo has definitely been banging his drum for confrontation over in the Gulf states this week. He's been all around trying to recruit them, like the United Arab Emirates was last week, into signing deals with the Israelis. Now, of course, we know the background to this, Martin, is that these Gulf states have been working very closely with Israel for many, many years. It's just a question of whether they would like to say that publicly, because their own population in those countries might not be too happy about that.
Not that that matters, because they're not democratic countries.
Well, I mean, it does. If you're not necessarily in a stable position as a ruler, then you might find that your population may even revolt against you, you know, in some way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a big difference, isn't it, between doing these deals with the Israelis secretly behind closed doors and saying, actually, it's our good old Israeli brothers. A lot of people, particularly Muslims in those countries, would be not necessarily happy with that.
Well, I think you'll see that Mohammed bin Salman was supposed to meet with Netanyahu in the US this week, but he's bottled it.
He pulled out.
For the kind of reasons you've just suggested.
In the Middle East Eye this week, Pompeo ends his Middle East tour without a single state agreeing to normalisation with Israel. Bahrain, Oman and Sudan have all failed to follow the UAE's lead in normalising ties with Israel. US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo headed home yesterday, marking the end of a Middle East tour, which was effectively, Martin, a total failure.
Yeah, but of course what's going on is that the Iranians have said this week that the attack on Natanz and various other things was definitely sabotage. So that's definitely the Israelis and the Americans, presumably with British support, attacking things inside Iran. You see, the Iranians might turn around and say, hang on a minute, you're supporting blowing up our stuff. Maybe we ought to come to your country and blow up some of your stuff. And then we can have a negotiation, can't we, on the basis of equality. And, of course, we've got the bomb in Beirut, which senior people in Lebanon have already hinted, and Trump himself hinted, was a bomb attack. And that bomb attack that killed hundreds of people wasn't carried out by Hezbollah, wasn't carried out by the Russians, wasn't carried out by the Chinese. It's probably carried out by the Israelis, those friends of humanity.
Unfortunately, a lot of this information you're not going to get on the World Service, you're not going to get on BCFM, you're not going to get on Radio Bristol, but you will get it here. I mean, let's just have a little bit more closely look at this deal between the UAE and Israel. This Middle East Eye article explains, just 1 week after the announcement of the UAE-Israel deal, Israel has strongly objected to the Americans' plans to sell US F-35 stealth fighters to the Emirates, resulting in the UAE cancelling a meeting that was set to take place in Abu Dhabi with Israeli officials. So it's already coming off the boil, that particular pot. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu denied reports the UAE deal hinged on the F-35 sale, but says he opposes any move that could reduce Israel's strategic military edge in the region. Speaking to Agence France-Presse, Lovett said that it is possible that a lack of clarity on the US commitment to deliver F-35s to the UAE could also play a part in slowing a second wave of normalisation amongst other Gulf states and also Sudan. So this is a really interesting side to all of this, isn't it? This is what this deal is really about. It's nothing to do with normalising relations with Israel. The UAE, the Emiratis, just want these F-35s, and the Americans said if you want them, you've got to go sign this Israel deal.
Well, that may well be so, Tony. That, of course, the underlying all of this is the hostility of the Sunni monarchies, dictatorships, and the Israeli dictatorship, which is effectively what it is from a Palestinian point of view, their hostility to Iran. And that overwhelms any kind of hostility.
But the Israelis, surely the Israelis would be wise to say, well, yes, actually, let's not object to the Emiratis and the other Gulf states having these F-35 jets, because that would actually mean that more of these Gulf states would be openly supporting Israel and against Iran.
Well, the danger is, of course, that there might be revolutions in those countries, as happened in Iran in 1979, and then the revolutionaries would have access to the F-35 jets and so on, as the Iranians captured all of the US materiel that the Iranian army had been armed with in the 1970s. The situation is very, very tense. The Iranians are waiting to see who wins the election in November. They're not going to go to war yet, because they're hoping that Biden probably would be let more biddable than Trump, because Trump's definitely in the pocket of the Israelis. Although Kamala Harris made a speech yesterday saying that her support for Israel was unconditional, which is frankly absurd. But there it is. And, before long, we may be plunged into a Middle East war, and worrying about COVID and the American election will be, you know, just yesterday's news.
Okay, well, let's go back to look at the UK now for a little while. And this week, some pretty shocking stuff in last week's Mail on Sunday, a fascinating article about the disappearance of various scientists over in Wuhan. Not just the first person that caught the disease, but, you know, other scientists as well. And that was, well, I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Lots of stuff coming out. The idea, of course, that the Pentagon had a big operation going on over there. So if this is the China virus, maybe it was the Pentagon China virus. Do you want to just say what you make of that idea, Martin? Is it possible?
Well, I mean, you can see that the Trump administration and the Murdoch press in Australia are pushing the idea, and you heard it in Trump's speech there, that the Chinese deliberately leaked this virus. They could have stopped it, but they didn't, etc., etc. Now, it's logically possible that it leaked from their Wuhan laboratory, but it's perfectly logically possible that it was actually smuggled into China by Western deep state for two reasons. A, they want to smash the Chinese economy. We're no longer going to tolerate China, as Pompeo said. And don't forget, they've had all sorts of problems inside China with swine flu and with bird flu, and then human flu. And at the same time, they've allowed it to flow back over the US and through the West because they got an excuse to bail out the banking system for the second time since 2008. The banking system started to collapse in the US in September. In November, the Times of Israel reports that the Israeli Defense Forces were tipped off by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States of America that a pandemic was coming out of China in November. And September, you've got the markets collapse. November, the IDF are tipped off, and then it all starts to happen. And it takes a while for the Chinese to work out what's going on. They're a bit panicked. They're trying to work out what it is. And then eventually they realize what's going on, and then they lock down. And of course, they've been much more successful in controlling COVID than the US has been.
We've got some actually really quite good news this week, again from the Mail. New mutation of coronavirus may be a good thing. Strain common in Europe, America, and parts of Asia is more infectious but less deadly, expert claims. A mutated strain, D614G, seems to be more infectious but less deadly than the original. Top expert says maybe that's a good thing as it could lower the death rate. Well, obviously the death rate is going lower and lower all the time. Dr. Paul Tambaya said most viruses tend to become less virulent as they mutate. And Martin, this would of course correlate with this whole idea that this maybe was a man-made virus, because the various things that the geneticists would add to a virus, as the thing mutates, they are likely to fall away. So one of the spin-offs of all of this, of course, is that if people are getting tested, they may have the new strain of the virus, which is actually far less deadly. So that's actually a very positive sign that this doctor's come up with here.
Well, potentially so. Let's hope so. We're still not clear whether this is, I mean, I've read other things.
I mean, you could say, who is he? Okay, let's just have a look at who he is. Paul Tambaya, senior consultant at the National University of Singapore and president-elect of the International Society of Infectious Diseases. Evidence suggests the proliferation of the D614G mutation has coincided with a drop in death rates, suggesting it's less lethal. So a mutation is likely to actually, we're going to see less function of a virus as it mutates.
Well, hopefully so. I mean, I've read other stuff this week that suggested that it may have come from South China, from mines which were full of bat droppings, because people who were digging these bat droppings out started dying of COVID. Now, there's loads of, you know, there's still loads and loads of information, disinformation.
Well, look, looking at
stuff out there, isn't
just
there?
Looking at the death rates in the UK, as you can see the graph. I don't know if you can see it. I'll certainly put this graph up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The UK coronavirus death toll as of yesterday, August the 7th. 17th, it shows a declining trend in mortality, unknown which strain each individual dies of, but D614G, believed to be the most infectious and least deadly, is thought to be dominant now in the UK. So it's almost as if nature's taken its course here. This thing, which was potentially, anyway, put out by the military or somebody along those lines, has slowly but surely run out of steam.
Yeah, well, it's if this is true, It's good news because it basically means people can be infected and therefore not even vaccinated.
This would explain
without dying or getting really ill.
Okay, so
we can't presume
but
anything.
If this is true, okay, it's a great big if this is true, it means that the people who are testing positive, and it would give be an explanation as to why so many people who have been testing positive after being contact traced for COVID-19 say they haven't got any symptoms. Because actually, what they're dealing with is a fairly, denuded strain of this. Anyway, I thought we'd have a listen to your favourite doctor, who is Martin, Dr. Vernon Coleman, who's living over in France now. He's the former British doctor, if I can find him. And here is his, I think, witty, humorous quip on the social implications as well of what's been going on with the pandemic this week.
In a document re-released from the British government's official advisers at SAGE, surely the most unsuitable acronym in history, confirms what I've been saying for months, that their advice to the government was to use the media to increase a sense of personal threat and to increase a sense of responsibility to others. May I remind you that we pay the fat salaries of these utter nutsards. Instead of looking after us, calming our fears and making us feel less stressed, they've deliberately been doing everything they could to terrorise us and to ramp up the scare stories. Distrust the government, avoid mass media, and fight the lies. Meanwhile, the leaders of the four nations in the United Kingdom have been doing everything possible to create confusion and extra anxiety. I plucked up the courage to take a look at the BBC website the other day and found the official rules on how and when people are allowed to meet one another. These are the official rules from the BBC website. In England, 6 people from multiple households or up to 30 people from 2 households can meet together outdoors. They mustn't get closer than 3 foot 3 inches. In Scotland, up to 15 people from up to 5 households can meet as long as they all keep 6 foot 6 inches apart. In Wales, any number of people from 2 households can meet as long as they're 6 foot 6 inches apart. And in Northern Ireland, up to 30 people can meet outdoors but must keep 3 foot 3 inches apart. The rules are equally confusing for indoor meetings. In England, 2 households can meet together. In Scotland, 8 people from 3 households can meet. In Wales, 2 households can form 1 extended household, whatever that means. It sounds like Welsh wife swapping to me. And in Northern Ireland, 10 people from 4 households can meet. There's no advice on what happens to citizens who live on a border between the two countries. The one conclusion from all this utter is that there's no science to any of this. Idiot civil servants and politicians have clearly made it all up. I bet they couldn't stop laughing to themselves as they wrote this garbage. Meanwhile, there's increasing evidence that less and less deaths are being marked down to COVID-19 and more people are immune. The testing is a nonsense, as unreliable as Tony Blair, but as the positives turn up with predictable regularity, so governments use the results as an excuse for more and more and tougher laws. There's no longer any doubt that health policy is being used to achieve geopolitical goals. We are at war with our own governments, with many of our universities, and with much of our media. In fact, virtually all of it, mainstream media. In the long term, we need to sweep clean the stables and create a new political and administrative system. We need new leaders, new media, and new management. Our politicians and public servants have done worse than fail us. They have betrayed us. Thank you for watching An Old Man in a Chair, and thank you for all your support and encouragement.
Okay, that's Dr. Vernon Coleman there, the author of How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. He's been going a long, long time. I've been following him for years, and it's really interesting. He seems to have become a kind of almost. His YouTube channel has done extremely well, anyway, what do you make of him saying? Actually, we need a new way of doing things completely. I mean, you might not agree with what he says on the COVID, but there is this whole idea coming along, isn't there, of the Great Reset? And he's saying we need something completely different.
Well, in that case, he's saying we need a great reset. It's just his version of a great reset, if you like. And certainly there is going to be a great reset, if you like, of one kind or another.
Isn't there going to be a competition?
The question is who's going to run it.
Exactly. So what, you know, who's in the running for that? Is it just the World Economic Forum and Prince Charles and Davos? Are they the only people who are going to really determine
it? I think the Chinese Communist Party have got some plans. If you're thinking about who the real competition is.
Okay, so this you were talking about sort of development banks, et cetera, Russia and China are involved in?
Yeah. I mean, basically what's going on, you talk about we're at war. Well, we are at war. People in Beirut know we're at war. People in Iraq know we're at war.
Talking about an information war.
No, I know, but I mean, it's a bit irritating that he uses this term war when what he means is, you know, we're disagreeing about using face masks. There is actually a war going on. People are dying every day, have been for decades. We're totally involved in it in this country. We've got soldiers all over the world backing it all up, and intelligence officers and all the rest of it.
If you can't warm to Vernon Coleman, how about Peter Hitchens? Because I know in the past you've been quite supportive of him, haven't you?
Well, he's been quite sensible about Syria, but apart from that, he's a silly Tory in my view.
Okay,
but there you go.
Let's have a listen to what Peter Hitchens has been saying. He looks upon this as a bit of a mind control exercise, but here he is talking on Talk Radio last week.
My side should now perhaps adopt the view of the government. We need to frighten people more to get them to realise how serious what's going on is. Mm. You remember that the extraordinary SAGE document back on March the 22nd, in which the government experts said a substantial number of people still do not feel sufficiently personally threatened.
Yeah.
The perceived level of personal threat needs to be increased among those who are complacent, using hard-hitting emotional messaging. The following day, the day after that piece of advice was delivered, they shut down the economy and introduced mass house arrest. Mm. And it's all been based on fear. And very effective it is, too. People in huge masses are afraid of something which isn't really a menace to them. Well, they're not afraid of something which is the invasion of their privacy and of their personal freedom, and indeed the takeover of the state by effectively a very small body of people, unaccountable, shortly to move into a special space age office in the cabinet office, completely uncontrolled by parliament, completely unrestrained by the judiciary. We are effectively living in a country which is turning into an autocracy. While I am absolutely not an apologist for Mr. Lukashenko in Belarus, it seems quite funny for everyone to getting so pious about his obviously rigged elections and his repression, as we in our own country head to towards our own version of an unfree, lawless, autocratic state. Most people conform. Most people do. And this is what people do. This is a country where we make rude jokes about the number of French people who collaborated with their occupiers. What do you think we would have done if we'd been occupied by people who shot and tortured anyone who can? But even we don't even need to be shot and tortured, do we? We just need somebody to say, we'll fine you £50 if you don't wear... Actually, the British law on this, or the English law on this, to be more specific, is actually quite open to allow dissent, which people could use if they wanted to. And this is the amazing thing, people don't. But they're saying this to look tough. They know perfectly well that the levels of compliance are extremely high.
Yeah.
It's just done in much in the way that Priti Patel pretends to be tough on immigration. It's just done to look tough, not to be tough.
Yeah.
To actually mobilize the police to go around grabbing everybody in the street who wasn't wearing a muzzle and dragging them in and forcing them to pay fines. They're not going to do that.
You've got Italian military people hanging out of planes with binoculars staring at people on a beach to see whether they're not lying on a sunbed.
Well, you have to ask yourself, as with all photographs, how, like all those pictures of mass graves and huge piles of coffins and all the rest of it that we saw at the beginning of this, how do these pictures come to be taken?
Well, presumably there's a press guy in the plane.
Yeah, and who asked him up? I mean, you try and get a trip in a military plane normally. The point is, any photograph like that, you have to ask yourself, how did it come to be taken? And the answer is, obviously, these things are arranged.
Yeah.
It's the idea that if the Italian Air Force spots somebody out of line on the beach, the plane is going to swoop low, and from loudspeakers on its wings, and terrible imprecations going. Well, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's terribly surreal.
It creates an atmosphere of surveillance, which gullible people, and there are a lot of gullible people,
there really are,
will fall for.
Yeah.
As I keep stressing, my own life is one of great good fortune, and I'm probably largely left alone, but I do grieve for the country. You sit down, you read George Orwell's thoughts about the English people, this is a country where people say, you can't run me in for that, you can't do that here. And these statements were true, and it simply was the case until quite recently, that it really was different here. The government did have more limited powers over us than practically anywhere else in the world. And it's vanishing before our eyes, and nobody cares. Yeah. I have to be upset by that, surely. If I weren't upset by that, there'd be something wrong with me.
That's Peter Hitchens invoking George Orwell there, Martin. He's a bit of a chameleon, isn't he?
Yeah, well, George Orwell gets invoked by lots of people. He was actually a tout for MI5 and MI6. He grassed loads of people up who were communists, in his view.
Peter Hitchens, not George Orwell.
Well, no, I'm talking about George Orwell.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they were all their careers ruined. So Orwell the saint is he's a saint to some people. He was no more better or worse than many other people. The idea that Hitchens has got that one time Britain was a free country and then gradually it's all been taken away, I think it's just rubbish. I mean, basically it's always been a pretty conformist place. In the 1950s, people were given sarin up at Porton Down.
What he's saying, you've got to agree with the basic point here, is that the government is becoming useless, more useless. Over the years, it's slowly but surely, since World War II, and we're going to be hearing from Mohammed Rafiq in a minute, in the 1950s and 60s, it was fairly well organised. It's just going down, an almost terminal slide at the moment.
Well, what's happened is that the state used to be more omnipresent than it subsequently became. Don't forget, we had rationing into the 1950s, for example. But at the same time, the state also actually did a reasonable job of things like providing schools and buses. What's happened is that the state has become weaker and weaker at doing the stuff that we want it to do, but more and more overblown at doing the stuff we don't want it to do, like invading Iraq. Trump mentioned there Biden's support of the invasion of Iraq. So did virtually the 100% of the Republican Party. It caused a million people to die. It's still not over. The war goes on, but it's all just electoral games for us. Biden supported it. And the current government in this country, Boris Johnson and all the rest of them, they all supported it. And then they go on about, that's nothing to do with us. That was Blair. You supported all of that. And, of course, the consequences for countries that decide to go to war with other countries, like Iraq, is that you end up with bombs going off and people being killed in your own country.
OK, as a way to round off, we'll be hearing a bit more from him next week, because we're going to be doing a 9/11 special for a couple of hours next week with Ian Henshaw, who'll be dropping in on Bristol. That's what he's told me earlier on today, anyway, the author on 9/11. And doing a bit of a comparison, because it's funny enough, Ian was one of the first people on the BBC World News who was interviewed about COVID-19 in Britain, because it was his next door neighbour who was supposed to be the first carrier of the illness into the UK, even though he didn't seem to be very ill. And also, as we know, there's lots of evidence that the disease was circulating in the UK well before it was supposed to have been in March, and in fact probably here in Bristol, the BBC Natural History Unit on the 17th of December, and a crew flew in and spread it around in the BBC offices, although they haven't actually reported that yet. Maybe they never will. What do you make of this idea, Martin, that actually it was quite widespread in the Icelandic people said it was the Alps that it was mainly in, but it was spreading to Iceland from there and from the UK, that it was in the UK, possibly the US, but certainly in some of these countries well before it was even supposed to exist?
There's plenty of people who are saying exactly that, but I come back to the Times of Israel saying that the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States said to the Israeli Defence Forces that there was going to be a pandemic in China the following month. How did the DIA know that?
Good question. Right. Well, we're going to hear now from former psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett. He certainly believes that there's elements of psychological warfare involved in the way the media is being used in the COVID-19 so-called pandemic, which certainly, if you look at the graph on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, looks to have been over about 2 months ago. And so let's have a listen to Scott Bennett, what he makes now of the success or otherwise of the polio vaccine. Because we heard on the BBC and other Western news networks this week the great news that polio has now been gotten rid of in Africa. Actually, the fact of the matter is it's still there. It's actually only a vaccine. Induced polio. So there is polio, but it's been put there by vaccines, not by the natural polio. Anyway, let's see what Scott Bennett has to say about that and COVID-19 a bit more generally now.
We've seen Indian children, thousands of Indian children, come down with polio after Bill Gates's vaccines. We've seen the Italian politician stand up in the Italian parliament and condemn Bill Gates as a criminal for his vaccine poisoning of people.
Well, that's right. She said he should be arrested, didn't she?
Yes, and he should be arrested. He should be charged for war crimes and executed for the damage that he's done. And he's openly said depopulation of the earth is his objective. So this is an instrument. This is a means to an end is through this false vaccination. So I'm opposed to it, absolutely. The COVID-19 thing, as far as I'm concerned, I don't believe much of it. I don't buy into it. I think, if anything, it is a result of a combination of the chemtrails that they've been polluting the air with and all sorts of other toxicities. There's also a branch that ties it in with 5G technology deployment is having a poisoning effect on the cells. There's a lot of different areas that need to be examined, but the psychosis that is being infected in the populations is very palpable. You can see the media, hear the politicians like Joe Biden demanding that everyone wear a mask. Well, that dehumanizes people. That disconnects people. That puts people in a state of fear.
Yeah, but it might save your life, Scott.
That's the cultic presentation. It'll save your life if you just stay in your basement, don't come out, wear a mask, and starve to death by not working, and keep your children home to be on video monitors like 1984, and that's their education. We've witnessed a shackling of human society, but I don't think it's going to take root and last, because we said the president and really America and society only had a couple months before this would start to explode. And right after a couple months went by, when people agreed to shut down, they didn't know what this was all about. But yet the media and the politicians and the Democrat side were hysterical that everything needed to be stopped, all businesses, all people locked in their homes and forced to wear masks. A couple months after that, people started breaking out, and then you had the George Floyd protests and the violence, which seemed to be engineered with a lot of Antifa, Black Lives Matter, LGBT protestations combining into a militant revolutionary wing that is causing massive disruptions in the cities in the United States.
Okay. So, Martin, a lot in there. I wouldn't necessarily go along with him invoking the whole idea of chemtrails having really anything to do with it whatsoever. But he's saying there that he believes that the there's an element of engineering to some of these Black Lives Matter demonstrations. Is that possible? Is it? I mean, because we've seen this sort of thing in Ukraine, we've seen it in Belarus, we've seen the whole color revolution system happening in many countries, actually. Is it feasible that this kind of thing is now rolling out here? And has it been, have the elites been doing this for generations, you know, organizing protests, having various groups on the streets that they want for their own political purposes?
Well, even if it was spontaneous, they'd want to infiltrate it and manipulate it. And, of course, there's an element, the Black Lives Matter movement is amorphous. You've got kind of official spokespeople who are paid for by corporations. Frankly, that's where the money comes from. And you've also got random people who are just identifying with it because they saw something on their Twitter feed. And of course they've been manipulating. Gladio was running in Western Europe for many years. They were running both fascist terrorists, left-wing terrorist groups, and it was all being orchestrated from inside the military-industrial complex. And of course, people can be genuinely, I mean, a lot of people who were members of the Red Brigades, for example, were genuine left-wing terrorist militants. But the Red Brigades itself was ultimately controlled by the CISMI, and they were the ones who kidnapped and assassinated the Prime Minister.
Well, we also had anarchist attacks here in Bristol, didn't we? Is any hint that maybe they were manipulated?
Well, yeah, but there was supposedly an anarchist attack on, if you remember, on the they burnt down the police firearms training place out at Portishead. And I don't think that was carried out by anybody I knew or had in any, you know, it's too big a job.
Well, they wouldn't tell you, would they?
Well, no, but in any case, it's too big a job. It's just not likely that they did. And the fact is that the police officers were murdered by Gladio terrorists in the 1970s. You know, it's quite feasible. I've been on RT this week talking about the Navalny poisoning, whatever it is, but it's quite likely that Navalny would be poisoned by Western agents who are trying to create a conflict with Russia. And people say they wouldn't do stuff like that. I say that's just not the case. We know that the special demonstration squad in Britain from the 1960s onwards infiltrated literally hundreds of plainclothes police officers into virtually every movement anybody listening to this show has ever been involved in. CND, you know, Save the Whale, all of it totally infiltrated. SWP. And then, you know, we've already got a police state. So when, you know, privileged posh boys like Peter Hitchens going about, we used to live in freedom. I just makes me laugh, give a hollow laugh. You may have done, the rest of us haven't.
Can you just give us your take on, for those of you, Martin, the very few out there that didn't hear you and didn't see you on Russia Today this week, what's your take on the so-called poisoning of Navalny? He's now been brought over to Germany, hasn't he?
Well, I was called out almost as soon as we'd heard what had happened. They said, well, can you make a comment on this? Well, what happened was something happened and he was on a plane, and it was a standard plane. It wasn't a private plane, and they immediately landed it, and he was immediately taken to hospital. And he's basically diabetic. He said he's diabetic. So that's by far the most likely explanation. He's just had a diabetic attack. But of course, they then allowed him to be flown to Germany, where he's been placed basically under the control of the BND, the German intelligence services. And they've got a line to spin, which is that he's been poisoned. And I saw Johnson wading in today saying, oh, well, he's obviously been poisoned and we must do, you know, more sanctions, etc.
Oh, dear.
Now, in other words, why would the Russian state, deep state or Putin, want, if they wanted to kill him, surely they would have killed
him. I'll tell you why, because he's the main opposition.
No, he's
in
not
Russia.
The main opposition.
Well, that's what the BBC World Service has been saying.
Whenever he stood for election, Navalny has got absolutely derisory.
His big success was in 2012 when he got 30% of the vote to be mayor of Moscow. And since then, he's basically nobody.
Well, no, he's not nobody. He's somebody.
Well, he's not a winner of elections.
But the whole way in which this whole thing is presented in the West is ridiculous. The biggest opposition party in Russia to Putin is the Communist Party, and they nearly won the election in the 1990s, but bombs went off, orchestrated probably by the Russian secret services working with the West to prevent them winning the election. Lukashenko, I hate to say it, but it's quite clear that he did win the election. He didn't get 80% of the vote. He probably got something like 65-70% of the vote. But he definitely won it. And the reason he won it is exactly that they were going on about having strikes in the Minsk tractor factory last week. Hardly anybody has gone on strike from the Minsk tractor factory. A couple of hundred people walked out with us. They employ thousands. And the reason is because if the opposition won the election, which they didn't, the first thing they'd do is close the Minsk tractor factory and send everybody.
Sell it off. Sell it to a Western company.
Yeah, but they wouldn't sell it off, because what would happen is, what's happened is that the big companies in Belarusia are all linked to the agricultural economy. So they produce tractors and fertilizer. And, you know,
I bet they produce them cheaper than a lot of the tractors and the fertilizer that British farmers
buy. Indeed, they've got very low cost base, so that's why they're able to continue functioning. But also the other thing, of course, that they're able to continue functioning is because they get loads of cheap gas and oil from the Russians. So, you know, and basically that's in the interest of the Russians, just to keep them all. I mean, and that's why Lukashenko stayed in power for 26 years. But he said, I'm not going to change all of that. We're going to carry on doing exactly the same as we've always done it.
Let's just get back to Russia for a minute and Navalny. What do you think is really at the heart of this, though? Because we keep hearing, don't we, about him being a great opposition hero that Putin is so jealous of, and yet actually it's the Chinese. Sorry, not the Chinese. The Russian Communist Party is still very strong in politics. Where are the real opposition to Putin? Because this is what he's always he's always presented as the main opposition to Putin. But actually, that seems to be only in the Western media. Nowhere else in the world. There's not in diplomatic or ambassadorial circles. Nowhere does this guy feature really, apart from in the Western press. But so, who is the real opposition?
Well, you've got two sources of real opposition to Putin. One is the Communist Party. Zyuganov was the president of that, but they put up a different guy to stand in the last election. But they got 17 to 20% of the vote, far in excess of anything Navalny's ever got. The other main opposition is the Liberal Democrat Party, which is not like Tim Kent's Liberal Democrat Party. They really are Russian nationalists. Incidentally, Navalny is also a Russian nationalist. He doesn't like foreigners or immigrants and so on. So he's presented in the West as this great liberal guy. But in actual fact, his views are rather illiberal when it comes to that. But of course, he's regarded in the West, frankly, as many of Ksenia Sobchak and others, as basically Western puppets. I mean, basically, they're paid by the Americans. Okay. They get full salaries
round this off by explaining why you think it's feasible that the West is behind this and not Putin?
All right. Well, let's just see what happened in the Maidan Square in 2014. Loads of pro-EU demonstrators were shot through the head by snipers, and so were several police officers. And on the back of that, there was a coup which forced Yanukovych out of the country, even though he'd just done a deal with the opposition the day before, and a new regime came in. The police officers from the Berkut police were arrested, and they were charged with shooting the demonstrators. There's been a court case in Kiev which showed that they did not shoot the demonstrators. The demonstrators were shot by a group of 50 assassins who were brought in with Shakashvili, who was fishing in those waters, used to be president of Georgia, was very pro-Western. They orchestrated the shooting of those people. And that's been reported in Kiev. I mean, it's good to say that.
Why does this mean Navalny?
Well, let me come to this. So that shows that the Western intelligence services, NATO intelligence services, were quite prepared to shoot up to 80 pro-EU, pro-Western demonstrators in order to overthrow the regime. Navalny is a puppet and therefore expendable. And as I said on RT, if he has been poisoned, the first question the police have got to ask is who had access to him, who's in his entourage. Because in actual fact, the West is quite capable of murdering low-level people create trouble.
Is it even possible that he may be killed in Germany and that blamed on Putin?
Well, they'll have to find, if that's what, at the moment, he's in a stable condition in the German hospital. But they've said they can't find any poison. But he must have been poisoned. And the Russian doctors have all said that's an insult to us. Saved his life. They said, but we couldn't trace any poison.
They were saying on the World Service this morning that it was actually a nerve agent.
Well, I mean, what they're doing there is they're just repeating the same old themes. What's happened here is he's had what looks like a diabetic attack, a chlorinase suppression of whatever, but lots of things cause that. If it was nerve agent, it would have killed the whole of Salisbury. And if he'd been poisoned with nerve agent, everybody on the plane would be dead. It's just nonsense. It's creating this image, Putin the poisoner. Putin, he poisons people. Oh, yes, but we all know that Putin poisons people, except we don't. We do know that NATO intelligence services kill pro-EU demonstrators. What should follow on from that is the Kiev police should start to say, right, we know that a US colonel was involved in this, because the people who testified from Georgia said a US colonel gave us the instructions. They should be sending to the United States of America, right, we want to extradite that person to stand trial in Kiev. They're not going to do that because they're a puppet state. But at the same time, they had to release the Berkut police because they didn't do the shootings. NATO intelligence services. And the rumours I've heard is that they were brought in via the Warsaw Police Academy, where they were given their instructions by British Army officers. Now, maybe those British Army officers should stand trial in Kiev for mass murder. And then maybe people would begin to understand how vicious NATO intelligence services actually are.
Well, it wouldn't be so surprising, wouldn't it? Because we've had so many former Nazis actually incorporated into NATO after World War II. So there seems to have been almost a kind of Nazi continuity network going on.
Well, what we're dealing with here is the techniques and the standard operating procedures. They are quite capable of very devious behaviour. So that the Prime Minister of Italy is kidnapped ostensibly by a left-wing terrorist group, but in actual fact by elements from the state itself. And he was a moderate, middle-of-the-road guy, and they made sure that he died because he wanted to bring the Communist Party into the sharing in the government of Italy.
All this organised by Licio Gelli and his P2 committee that were actually running the country.
Well, indeed. And, of course, they didn't stop doing this at the end of the Cold War. And, of course, I think it's quite significant what happened in Kiev, because it's quite clear that NATO, in 2014, assassinated pro-Western demonstrators in order to carry out a coup.
So
that's how vicious they are.
Impossible. Anyway, Martin, thank you for giving us actually probably a fuller version than you gave to Russia Today on that particular story. Anyway, we're going to move now to look at something a bit more local. We did hear last week about disgruntled St. Paul's residents feeling that they'd had no consultation at all over a massive 5G mast which has gone up in St. Paul's here in Bristol. And one of the arguments, of course, which is put forward by people like Freya Lockwood, who will not reply to my phone calls or texts or messages or emails, only to say I've got to ask Bristol City Council, and then they never reply when I want to try and get her to talk about Bristol smart cities and how wonderful 5G supposedly is. What they'll tell you is that it cannot cause cancer. Well, the actual argument used by most of the pro 5G people is they say, well, actually microwaves are not ionizing radiation, and they're quite right. If you look at the spectrum of the electromagnetic spectrum, you go up in frequency from microwaves, and then you start getting towards visible light. You go through the visible light spectrum, and it's only once you get to the end of that with ultraviolet light and on beyond to X-rays and gamma radiation that you actually start getting ionizing radiation. And they're basically saying that it's only ionizing radiation at the very top end of the spectrum, well away from these microwaves that are used for 5G, 4G and the rest, that you're likely to get cancer. Well, actually, according to the Environmental Health Trust and Dr. Deborah Davis, that's complete nonsense. So let's have a little listen to her and what she's got to say about microwaves causing cancer now.
Mobile phones do not pop popcorn. That was a fraud. They don't make any heat that we know of, otherwise they wouldn't be permitted. But they do go through things that contain fat and fluid. And we are now working in Environmental Health Trust with scientists at the University of California, San Francisco, scientists, formerly the president of the American Cancer Society of California, because we are seeing women who keep cell phones in their bras. Has anyone seen a woman put a cell phone in her bra? Hands up, please. Please tell them you've heard now why they shouldn't do that. And here I want to show you our first case report from 2009, and we now have many more. This was a Chinese-American woman, who used her cell phone 4 hours a day in her bra for 10 years while she was driving. Now, and you drive with a phone on your body. The phone is smart. It's going to go from one tower to another, and it's going to say, here I am, where are you, here I am. And it's going to be going to max power each time it moves from one cell tower to another. And there it was right next to her chest. And the tumors that developed right under the antenna of the phone. Unusual tumors. Well, you know, that's a very good question. Does it apply to males who would put the phone in their breast pocket? We actually have cases now of men with unusual skin cancers or unusual growths where they've kept their phone in one place. And again, if they were phones would not be past testing approval if they were to do that. Male breast cancer is very rare, very, very rare. But we are seeing some reports of cases. And here, unfortunately, this is an MRI of a young woman, a very brave young woman named Tiffany France. When she was 21, she's now 22, she developed metastatic breast cancer. This is metastases into her chest wall right here. And this outlined the phone. And it was subcutaneous, so it's like right under the surface of the skin. It was not deep within the breast. Most breast cancer occurs in women over 50. It occurs in the upper outer quadrant. These tumors occur right under the antenna of the phone. And now we have 38 of them. Not a single one of them has a family history. None of them has inherited the defects that we know increase the risk of breast cancer. They have multifocal tumors. That means they have more than one tumor, and the tumors are located under the antenna, sometimes just right in the center of the chest. So we're collecting information because that's what we do in science. But we want to, in the meantime, issue precautionary advice because that's also what we do in public health when it comes to setting public policy. When it comes to further work on the prenatal impacts, my colleagues at Yale University have taken mice, exposed them to mobile phone radiation, and they have found significant effects on those mice's behavior as adults. All right? Prenatally exposed mice have hyperactivity as adults. And these are some of the data. They have worse memory. They're more hyperactive. They have more anxiety. And because of that, that is why we've developed the Baby Safe Project, working with colleagues at Yale University and around the world. Now, how many of you had heard that in 2011, the World Health Organization had reviewed all of the evidence and decided that mobile phone radiation was a possible human carcinogen? How many people had heard that? Okay. It's interesting that that information isn't more widely known, and we can explore the reasons for that perhaps at a later time. But the fact is, the group that reviewed this evidence for the World Health Organization looked at all the evidence at the time in 2011. At that time, they said it's important to conduct additional research and it's important to take pragmatic measures to reduce exposure. But we are not conducting additional research. And in fact, the World Health Organization itself is no longer conducting a leading study on brain cancer and mobile phones.
So that's Dr. Deborah Davis from Environmental Health Trust. Terrific video, as not seen on the BBC, all about how dangerous microwaves are. And there's particularly all sorts of stuff about bees as well, Martin, we're going to hear about in a minute. But it's quite clear that the industry has decided it's going to lie to the world and say, well, because it's not ionizing radiation that's coming out of these phones and these masts, that it can't cause cancer. Well, that's just not true.
I don't know enough to say for sure. I mean, that's a fairly strong presentation that lady made. No doubt the other side will have other things to say about it. But, I mean,
she's making a very strong argument, isn't she? She's saying basically the research is funded by them and it's all pretty much controlled.
Yeah, which is why you have the precautionary principle, isn't it? If you don't know whether something's dangerous or not, then you presume that it is until you can prove that it isn't.
What about this idea of research wonks up at universities saying, well, actually, at the end of the day, they're only going to do the research if they can come out at the end of it and say, it was a conclusion, actually, we need to do more research, because then that's another job for them.
That's true. But we've got this problem with anything that human beings do. There are vested interests, whether financial or just intellectual. You know, people don't like being wrong. They want to be right. They generally believe they are right. Otherwise, they wouldn't believe what they believe. And, you know, it's very hard to disentangle who's telling the truth.
Well, we were hearing from Tim Kent about special educational needs here in Bristol, about that being a war by parents having to try and get some, you know, their statutory legal rights for their children to be educated, which is a horrific position to put parents in. Thank you very much, Bristol City Council. But here she talks about, this is Deborah Davis again, talks about wargaming, the mobile phone research, which is an incredible idea, is that they've sat down, these companies, this is what she's found, and they've decided that it's a war. We want to get our technologies out there. There's all sorts of people that want to stop us that actually, for example, value human health. And they're going to wargame it. So that's what she ends up concluding here in this next section from Dr. Deborah Davis from Environment and Health Trust.
Where you stand on an issue depends on where you sit and who's bought your chair. And there's a tremendous amount of sponsored research by people who are hired to do studies to find no effect. And that's plagued this field. in a number of countries, including within the government itself. So I don't know about the details here with Arpanza, but I can tell you in the United States today, the gentleman who is directing the Federal Communications Commission, Tom Wheeler, was for 10 years the executive director of the Cell Phone Telecommunications Industry Association. And now he's in charge of regulating those devices. So it's challenging to have a neutral playing field under that circumstance. One example, the U.S. Congress asked for a study of what needed to be done on mobile phone radiation in 1993, in 1998, in 2002, in 2012. That's how many times they've asked for that study to be done. So each time a study is done, and each time the conclusion is reached, we need more research. Well, that's my bread and butter. Of course we need more research. But if instead of funding the research, all you're doing is calling for it, then it becomes a bit of a smokescreen. So that's part of our challenge on this issue. It's a lot easier to call for research than it is to carry it out. This research is hard to do. It's not simple. There are real complexities to this field. Unfortunately, at least in the past, industry had a very clear strategy. And in my book, Disconnect, I document and quote in the new afterword that in 1994, when industry first became aware that there were studies suggesting that mobile phone radiation could damage brain cells of rats, a memo was written to, quote, war-game the science. War-game the science. This issue is far too important to be gamed. It's not a matter of war. It's a matter of the future health of your children and grandchildren.
Oh, well, we're leaving the European Union, Martin, and it's the EU regulators who decide whether mobile phones are safe or not. The only problem is we've just had a report out a month or so, maybe 2 months ago, from two members of the European Parliament saying basically the industry controls this group, so the industry is writing its own rules.
Yeah, it's what's called regulatory capture in the economics textbooks. And if you think about it, it's pretty obvious because you've got people who are basically part of the industry. They then become the regulators of the industry. And then when they finish being regulators, they go back to making money from the industry, whatever industry it is. And it could be, and of course we're talking here about mobile phones, but it could be anything really. And it's a real struggle. I mean, there isn't an easy answer. Because what you want is to have a state that's sufficiently independent to be able to regulate the private sector, but not to be beholden, have its own agenda, for example. I mean, one of the things, if you think about radar in World War II, people who were operating radars were told that it was perfectly safe. We now know that it wasn't safe at all, and that the people who were operated radar had all sorts of long-term consequences. But at the time, when you're trying to win the Battle of Britain, the long-term consequences of the people operating the radar aren't the first thing on the agenda. And that's real warfare, which actually really does lead to corners being cut, like the creation of the vaccine for flu, which probably caused the Spanish flu epidemic, originally at a base in the US in Kansas. And of course they're cutting corners because they need to get their soldiers out to the front line with the flu injections already inside them. Same with Gulf War syndrome from the first Gulf War, where they basically knocked them up with loads and loads of vaccines against what they thought Saddam Hussein might have because they'd supplied it to him. So you can see you've got two forces at work here. One is the corporate desire to just make money and not think about the consequences. You've also got the intellectual arrogance of people who've developed new technologies and they want them to go forward. And then you've also got the military For example, 5G clearly has all sorts of military applications, and it may well be that the Chinese, for example, are pioneering all of this because they want to be at the cutting edge of the military implications.
Martin, what military application does 5G possibly have? I mean, admittedly, the whole idea of mobile phone data was originally a military concept. The idea was that you could speak to people in the battlefield, and you could actually use that data connection to them to download maps and things like that, things that they needed to know about, for example.
That's right.
And that's where the mobile phone industry and data industry on mobile phone actually sprang from.
Yes, and the whole internet came out of, Pentagon spending, because the private sector won't invest enough money to develop the technologies concerned. So you often find cutting-edge technology is driven by military expenditure, and that goes back, in history. You'll see that the creation of the Bank of England, the Royal Navy, all of this was basically a military industrial complex in embryo, which of course continues to function to this day with much the same sort of agenda as it always had.
Well, we're going to go and have a listen now to a chap called Mohammed Rafiq, who sadly died a couple of weeks ago. He was a guy who used to work at the Bank of England. In fact, Martin, he was working there very hard and diligently during the Big Bang in the 1980s. I think it was 1986?
Seven, I think.
Margaret Thatcher and Victor Rothschild decided they were going to digitise everything that was done in the City of London. This is something that many people don't realise, that before that date, all various deals to do with exchange of share certificates, bearer bonds, all these sorts of financial transactions in the City of London. Many of them, Martin, used to be done by courier. So a guy on a motorbike with a share certificate or a piece of paper of whatever sort in a leather briefcase on a motorcycle would go from one bank to another and get a document signed, and everything had to be finished by the end of the day, and it was done in that way, in all physical bits of paper. But obviously the whole digital world changed all that. Do you think there was really much difference between what was going on with motorcycle couriers and bits of paper and the digital world?
Well, there's technological change in what's went on, as you pointed out, but more to the point is the changes in the regulations about what banks could and couldn't do. And so in the US, for example, in the 90s, they abolished the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment banking, i.e. speculation, from normal retail banking, where people put their funds in order to pay for their retirement or whatever. And, That was the fundamental change. And of course, we're now in a ridiculous world where BlackRock, which is a private hedge fund in the US, is now deciding who's going to get government bailouts to keep the show on the road to get Trump re-elected or not elected or whatever the plan is.
I mean, is there any real proposal from the Labour Party at the moment on any kind of sensible reform of the City of London?
Well, you'll find that no doubt people are making some noises in that direction, and people like Richard Murphy, Tax Justice Network.
Well, he seems to be gone completely from the scene now. When John McDonnell's left now, so these people have now been jettisoned from the party.
Yeah, well, I think even the more right wing members of the party can see that we've had another bailout of the financial services sector, just like in 2008. But of course, many of them think that that's just to do with COVID.
Well, I'd like to agree with you, but I seem to see most of the right wing sort of in the middle of fighting the left wing, and the left wing fighting the right wing. Anyway, let's have it. Before we hear from Mohammed Rafiq, this is a little bit cheeky, but it's a piece I was going to play in the first hour we didn't have time for. And this is the former Foreign Secretary, Labour Foreign Secretary, and the guy who stood for Leader, along with his brother David Miliband, sorry, Ed Miliband. And let's hear from David Miliband. This is what he was saying this week about what he thinks is too much infighting going on in the Labour Party at the moment, and who might be behind it.
One of the things that Keir Starmer is dealing with at the moment is the fight that the Labour Party still seems to be having about an election that happened 3 years ago, and this idea that Jeremy Corbyn would have won the 2017 election if only it weren't for people within his party. Do you believe that's right?
This is a pure wrecking tactic from Jeremy Corbyn and the Corbynites. Denial after four successive defeats is a route to more defeats. And we learnt that after 1992. We got out of denial and we won in 97. And actually, we won three elections on the trot. And if we don't really understand that when people got a look at Labour in 2017, we couldn't beat the worst Tory campaign in history, 750,000 votes we were behind. And then when people got the full measure of Jeremy Corbyn in 2019, he led us to the worst election defeat since the 1930s. So it's a wrecking tactic, and I hope people understand it for what it is.
Well, he's calling it a wrecking tactic, Martin. Some on the left are saying, well, actually, we're just exposing the infiltration of the Labour Party machinery, where people from the right were actually actively trying to undermine Corbyn and trying to stop him winning the election. Where do you stand on this one?
Well, if you actually look at what actually happened, Ed Miliband did reasonably well, but Corbyn did better. So the idea that by moving to the right, they would have done better, it's not the case. When you look at what happened in the, and he lost by a few thousand votes in a few constituencies under first past the post.
This is in the 2017
yeah,
general election.
But don't forget, but what's happened since then is that Scotland has decided to
in
go.
In fact, Theresa May was quite confident, wasn't she? She was so confident.
Oh,
she
yeah.
was going, oh, I'm going to get massive, massive majority now. Actually, she got a bit of a surprise, didn't she, on election day?
She did. But what's also happened since David Miliband was in charge, and of course, he full-heartedly supported the invasion of Iraq, which of course made the Liberal Democrats take loads of Labour votes in cities like Bristol. And of course, he was involved in things like rendition and all the rest of it.
Well, let me just remind you as well, he was the host for Roland Dumas when he was invited over to London 2 years before the beginning of the Syrian so-called civil war, where he was being invited by British officials to participate in the overthrowing of the Syrian government. So he's certainly not a whiter-than-white character. I mean, he was the guy in charge at the time. He was Foreign Secretary.
Yeah, all right, but leaving aside him as an individual, you've definitely got a tension between the left and the right of the Labour Party. There's always been a tension, going back to the 1930s. So it's not exactly news that there's still tension there. And of course, the fundamental problem for the right of the party is that with Scotland going its own way, Labour is not going to win in Scotland anytime soon. There's no way they can win just by winning the popular vote under first past the post. And this is where Corbyn's real mistake was. He should have come out in favour of proportional representation, as the left wing of the Labour Party did in New Zealand in the 1980s, and changed the electoral system. And they changed rugby union at the same time. They started to play it at a much faster pace with a lot more commitment. And of course, that was what should have happened in Britain. But they're stuck in the mud. Everybody just looks at the last election. David Miliband there just looks back to the Blair era as some kind of wonderful era.
Well, the Labour Party was actually in power.
Yes, and what did they do with it? Ultimately, they decided to invade Iraq to help the Americans out, which actually destroyed their own party. And that was likely
well, they
to destroy
started,
their own party.
They also started these horrendous parasitic PFIs as well.
Indeed, that was Gordon Brown was responsible for PFIs, particularly, because it was a way of spending money without having a
big debt. On the positive side, we got the building of places like Cabot Circus here, so a massive investment in city centres.
Yeah, well, which is all about to go down the drain anyway because of what's going to happen next.
Maybe they'll be turned into luxury flats, are we going to see?
Indeed. The point about this is when he goes around, we've had the worst elections in the 1930s, the popular vote actually stood up. It's just that because of the electoral system and the fact that Scotland no longer votes Labour, you've got no chance of winning. Starmer's got no chance of winning either.
It's also undermining in your own party. That doesn't help, does it?
No, it doesn't. If you've got a situation where Corbyn had already become the leader, they should have let him have a go at trying to, but they didn't. They twice tried to remove him, which they couldn't do. So it was a pointless exercise, and all it did is entrench the hostility on the other side.
But
in other European countries, there'd be just two parties there. There'd be like Die Linke's party in Germany and the SPD, and it wouldn't matter. You just have two parties, and people can decide which one.
So,
the
what point is the Labour left going to start another party then?
Not yet, because we've got first past the post, Tony. As long as we've got first past the post, we've got to stay in the same party. It's the only way.
Without people like Ken Livingstone and Chris Williamson, though.
Well, indeed. Indeed, but ultimately at some point...
And possibly you, for example.
Well, no.
For some of your views.
No, I'm not leaving.
You may be expelled. Expelled.
Well, maybe so. That's up to those who want to think like that. Ultimately, there's going to be... The political system doesn't represent the underprivileged in this country. If they vote Labour, the Labour Party has got to be a safe for the relatively privileged, therefore they can't do anything for the underprivileged.
Okay.
In other countries, with proportional representation, just like the way Sinn Féin has now become the main opposition in Ireland, they are. And of course, the government is already wobbling there. Soon enough, they're going to take over because the system allows that. It allows it in New Zealand too. You can kick for touch and you can, you know, and you can switch the ball and all sorts of things. But under first past the post, just as we've seen in the United States of America, we're going to have brain dead Joe Biden or brain dead Donald Trump, because that's the only option.
Just as
you're
touching on the whole situation in the Republic of Ireland, that is, I think, quite fascinating. The way that it looks now likely, people have looked back on this latest Irish election and said, well, if the Sinn Féin had stood more candidates, they might actually now be running the country.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of ramping up by Sinn Féin. I mean, Sinn Féin certainly, if they'd stood more candidates, would have had a bigger vote. But the problem they've got is that the traditional parties are so hostile to working with them, even though the loyalist parties.
That's like the Tweedledum Tweedledee party. Yeah, it's a bit like the British and American. Yeah, you've got the two main parties are actually working in lockstep.
Yeah, but at the same time, because you've got PR, new voices can come through. We imposed proportional representation on Germany in the 1940s to make sure that people couldn't just bluff their way into power on a minority of the vote.
So do you think Sinn Féin will charge in the next election in Ireland?
Well, they will obviously be hoping to win the next election in Ireland, for sure, yeah.
And I don't think the way that the main parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, have behaved is going to endear them to the voters
at all.
Well,
no, you know, the problem for them is that by forming a coalition, the Greens have also decided to join the coalition, of course. And, of course, they got wiped out because they were in coalition with Fianna Fáil. And then Fianna Fáil crashed the banks, as it was perceived, and the Greens got wiped out on the back of that.
And I'm suddenly reminded that we should really have asked Tim Kent in the first hour a bit about Ed Davey and what he makes of him, because he's just taken over as Lib Dem leader.
The problem for the Lib Dems is that nobody has heard that they're having a leadership election or has heard of Ed Davey, which is a bit unfortunate for them. So they're crying in the wilderness.
They are certainly in national politics still really suffering with a couple of things, with Jo Swinson and her attempt to completely reverse the Brexit vote without asking anybody. And the other thing, of course, is the whole gorgeous coalition relationship between Nick Clegg and David Cameron, which went down like a lead balloon. Anyway,
we've still got 11 MPs, which is a lot more than the Greens.
Well, it's just a kind of residual. Anyway, let's get on to talk about, or to hear from, in fact, Mohamed Rafiq, who died last week. He's an ex-Bank of England employee. And I spoke to him back in 2012, sitting in his Rolls Royce, actually, in, I think it was in Croydon. In fact, the engine ticks over so quietly in that car, you can hardly hear it in this interview. But he had some fascinating things to say as a former insider in the City of London.
It is not really possible to study central banking. The understanding that is taught in academia through economic circles has got very little to do with the practical reality on the ground. And that is simply because it's, you know, as the Americans would say, a bum steer. If people don't know what the actual subject is and the subject matter, they can talk till the cows come home about anything else. They can't fix anything because their core understanding is wrong. So even without the conspiracy theory element, which isn't a theory, it's a conspiracy fact, as I was describing the difference between the understandings there, and that's carefully managed because the people who understand what's going on pass that on an intergenerational basis, and it's a very limited need-to-know basis.
But it sounds almost like a cult.
Yeah, you could say it was almost like that. It was a money cult. I mean, these people had been earning from these processes for generations. In the same way somebody might be a rope maker or a candlestick maker or a smith of some description, these people passed on from one generation to the next so that their children got this instant leg in. The institutions that I worked for instance, were purely old Etonian. So if you didn't have the old school tie, and everybody knows this is not a theory, this is fact, historical fact. If you didn't have the school tie, you didn't get on the board. It was that simple. It was got nothing to do with capability or qualification. It was completely a privileged hierarchy.
Back in the 1970s and 80s, I mean, in the 80s, and when we started dropping off from the idea of full employment, at some point, Britain has gone from being a country where money actually serves the population and serviced the nation to a point where we're now feeling that actually we are serving the money system. At what point did that happen?
Well, I think it's always been like that. I think that after the Second World War, they lifted the yoke slightly. But if you go back pre-Second World War, you don't have to go back that far to find children cleaning the inside of chimneys, etc. So there was a system of slavery in this country that, although we like to look at slavery systems in other parts of the world, slavery did exist here. We had child slave labour. There were unions that fought against that to try and get some kind of equality in life. We kind of take all of those fights for granted now that went on back then and think that this system, which is slowly, insidiously seeping its way into becoming the master of our lives, is something new. It's actually something returning. And hence the old mantra, those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. If we study the history of this system, we'll see very clearly that all that's happening is a repeat of what's happened previously. It's been digitized, it's sold in a different way, where it's marketed and we're made to feel comfortable about it and made to feel that it's the right and proper thing, but actually it isn't. The whole thing needs challenging from the root up.
Well, that's a pretty good summary of what's happened. I'm reminded of the economist Kaletsky, because he was an economist who was quite prominent in what you might call the Keynesian era of full employment and nationalised industries and so on. And at that stage, and I went to university at the end of that sort of era, people were just saying, well, capitalism's reformed itself. It's not like it used to be back in the bad old days.
Oh, I think you've been a bit mean to him saying it's pretty good. I think it's better than you in some ways. No. He's talking there about from someone who's seen right at the very inside of the city of London. And he's talking about it as certainly this whole idea of Etonians, the intergenerational nature. This is like basically a money guild. Like the medieval guilds, that if you're born into it, then you know about it. And he's also saying there that our understanding, the economics, in fact, you say this quite a bit yourself, don't you? That actually it's the understanding and the teaching and the whole sort of university ethos around economics is completely wrong. And that's the way they like it, because they know what's really going on and you don't.
Yeah, well, coming back to what I was saying about the end of the Keynesian era, Kaletsky said, the problem is that they're never going to... basically, you've got full employment. Capitalism is working well in many respects. Of course, we were still having the Vietnam War and all the rest of it. But basically, capitalism, you know, there were universal schooling, healthcare, all of these things. But of course, it's only conditional. And the traditional ruling classes, the old Etonians, let's bring them into it, they were never going to accept that as a permanent setup. And that's what Thatcherism and Reaganism was all about. We're going to get rid of the last 30 years, what they call the 30 glorieux in France, the 30 glorious years. And we're back to the 19th century with the same kind of gaps between rich and poor, the same dominance of, in fact, there's more dominance of finance capital now than there was in that era. And we're now reaching a point where, you know, there is going to be an implosion as a result of the mismanagement of capitalism. Capitalism probably is going to collapse anyway because it's got all these tendencies towards collapse.
Well, it will
collapse.
Be pushed at the right moment. Insiders will make most money out of
it. Well, that may be so, but it may just break down of its own internal contradictions. But also, you've got... we bailed the banks out in 2008 and we bailed them out again in 2019. And of course, that was only supposed to happen once. And if it happens twice...
You mean 2020?
No, 2019 is when they started bailing the banks out in September, before the pandemic in November.
But we had this massive bailout in March, didn't we?
No, we had... Yeah, but the bailouts began in September 2019, which is when COVID then came along as the perfect cover story for bailing the banks out. And this, of course, is if we'd bailed the banks out without having COVID as a cover story, everybody would have been going nuts. Keir Starmer, got a picture of him there on the computer. He would have been going nuts. Why are we bailing the banks out? But of course, we all know why we're bailing the banks out.
That's if
it's
he was
of COVID.
Only if he was told to.
Well, don't judge Starmer too
harshly.
No, we're going to see which way he's going to jump. he will be infinitely better than the incompetents who are currently running the country.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but I'm not convinced that Starmer is really his own person. He doesn't really seem to make his own decision. Well, that is, we're starting to get into philosophical stuff there. So perfect time to move into to talk about our final item with David Livingstone, which is about Kabbalism. But before we do that, finally, I'm going to be speaking, I believe, in Castle Park here in Bristol. A group called Stand Up X is organising a whole tour. In fact, they sent me an email earlier where they say there's 25 cities in Britain in 27 days over the next month or so. They're doing basically a kind of grand tour with a bunch of organisers in their cars going from city to city to city, organising something called Stand Up X. Now, their idea, Martin, I don't know whether you think this is a good idea or not, is they're getting many of the critics of the current government, particularly the policy around masks and lockdowns and this sort of thing, together in these various cities to do that. So I'll put a link up on our show page to Stand Up X. And I don't think it's entirely finalised, but they're doing a kind of tour around the country. 25 cities in 27 days over the next month or so.
Well, people are entitled to do anything they want to do politically. But whether everybody's going to agree with them is another matter, isn't it? But me or you or them.
Well, we shall see. I'll certainly be setting out my stall. I quite like the idea that, you know, there'll be people that I very much disagree with and other people that I will agree with, and I'll probably learn something in the process. So that's Castle Park, 2 o'clock on Sunday. The other thing to say about that, I suppose, is that even though all the local media were notified of this, there's been nothing on the local media about it, whereas with the Black Lives Matter march, we had adverts, basically, on the local press on the Thursday and the Friday that it was going to happen at the weekend. We're not getting that at all with Stand Up X, so I don't quite know if the media have already decided there are good demonstrations and bad demonstrations. I suppose that would be normal, Martin, wouldn't it?
It would, because the media are not honour bound to be neutral. They can basically take any side they like, can't
certainly
they?
Certainly they are nowadays, you're right. But anyway, so this is, we're going to hear now from David Livingstone. He's the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, which is, I think, an absolutely terrific book delving into the modern manifestation of fascism, which is an obsession with technology, the idea that humans can genetically engineer themselves to be amazing and great, and, for example, to eliminate death from the genetic codes, this kind of thing, to hook up with computers, to plug in your nervous system to a computer. But anyway, this book is more really about, or this discussion is more about one of his books called The Dying God. And this is about the history of the Kabbalah from the Magi to the Assassins with David Livingstone.
So different scholars emphasize different sources. So some emphasize the Persian influence, some emphasize the Greek, some emphasize the other. Some tried to claim it was native to Judaism. Some said it was foreign to Judaism. And there's only one way to answer it. And that's the verse 102 of Baqarah in the Quran. And there it says that in Babylon, the Jews learned, if I can paraphrase it properly, they learned magic from the Satans. Mm-hmm. And the Satans practice what was preached by Harut, the angels Harut and Marut in Babylon, and they learned magic from them. And so the Jews who practiced this apostatized. They knowingly turned, it's, the Quran says, they turned their backs on their religion. So why this is important is that it pinpoints the emergence of the Kabbalah in the 6th century BC when the Jews were held there in captivity. And that's an important point because, first, as you know, Moses and his descendants went to Egypt. They stayed there for several hundred years. Joseph and his brothers went to Egypt. Their descendants were led by Moses out of Egypt. They went to Palestine. They conquered the land from the Canaanites. They were, according to the Bible, they were warned repeatedly to avoid the worship of their neighbors. Mm-hmm. And so the Canaanites practice a cult called the cult of the dying and rising God.
Mm.
And this is a God that dies in winter and resurrects in spring, corresponding with Easter. And basically what I show in my book, The Dying God, is that it's a satanic cult, effectively. This is recognized by, it's not recognized directly by scholars, but scholars recognize it as what they call a Catonic cult, which is a cult of, is a, the Gun God was worshipped as a god of the underworld. So, which is why Satan today is associated with hell, and hell is associated with the underworld. Because the dying god was worshipped as Pluto or Hades, which is the Greek Roman version of the devil. So they used to practice basically satanic rituals in worship of this dying god, typically that involve human sacrifice of children. And this is why you find mentions in the Bible that the Jews used to sacrifice their children to Moloch. Moloch is a version of Baal. And so Moloch is the planet Saturn. So out of the seven, at the time, there were seven known planets. And they make like a spectrum going from Jupiter to Saturn. And Jupiter represents am I getting that right? The sun, no, sorry, the sun to Saturn. So sun is gold and Saturn is lead. And Saturn is considered the opposite of the sun, is considered the nocturnal sun or the black sun. And so to Saturn, you perform evil sacrifices. So they used to have these rituals that used to involve intoxicants, sometimes, you know, different like psychoactive substances, dancing, demon possession, and human sacrifice. So the Bible, according to the Bible, God warns the Israelites repeatedly to avoid following to the cult of the dying god of the Canaanites. And they are warned several times and that unless they desist, that they will be taken into captivity and they'll be taken away. The temple will be destroyed. So this happens twice. So the first instance, the Assyrians are sent in. They conquer the northern kingdom of Israel and they are taken into parts of Iran and in the land of the Medes. So Iran and beyond. And that's where they become lost. So that's where the 10 tribes become the lost tribes of Israel. The two remaining tribes of Judah and Benjamin remain in Judah, but they are conquered several decades later by the Babylonians. Babylonians take them into captivity to Babylon. They remain there for about 50 years. And it's then that the apostatizing Jews learn magic from the jinn. And so what's interesting, there's one scholar in particular who nailed it. His name is Frantz Cumont, who's a Belgian scholar. And I've said this many times, in my estimation, he's the greatest scholar of the 20th century. Like the amount of knowledge a guy like this has is really, truly impressive. The problem is like a lot of modern scholars, and this is not my opinion, they're just expressed by a few leading scholars. They tend to focus on a particular path, and especially given the popularity of Greece, they'll focus on Greece or they'll focus on, but the problem is because the modern perception is that these civilizations evolved independently, very few of them recognize that they need expert knowledge in several civilizations to be able to understand one or all of them. So to understand Greek civilization, you have to understand Persian culture and you have to know it. You really got it. You can't just have a passing observation. You really have to understand it properly. Yeah, Persian culture in particular, and then Roman culture and Egyptian culture. So what Frantz Cumont pointed out is that after the 6th century BC, the world came to know about what were called magi. So they're in the Bible, the three magi that come to visit Jesus, right? So they're famous around the world.
One of the brothers, I don't know if you know about Dr. Merzaid, but one of the brothers I interview quite a lot, he talks about this, that the prophet, when he'd written his letter to Khosrow, he had specifically referenced the fact that if you don't accept Islam, you will be responsible for the sins of the Magi's. Specifically referencing that in the prophet himself referenced that. But anyway, please continue.
So it could be Zoroastrians they're referring to.
Yes.
But So the Magi became famous throughout the world. So the word magic comes from the Magi, right? So they became famous throughout the world as sorcerers and magicians. And so the problem is that when scholars of Kabbalah look at the influence of the Persian religion or Zoroastrianism on Kabbalah, there's no relationship. And this is the part they don't get. So they're like, they dismiss. So they look at Zoroastrianism and say, no, it has no influence whatsoever on Kabbalah, except very remote. So what Franz Kimmel pointed out is that there's a lot of secondary evidence that describes the cult of the Magi. And when you look at it, it has no relationship whatsoever to Zoroastrianism, even though the Magi were supposedly priests of Zoroastrianism. Mm. So what he identifies, as well as another scholar, which is R.C. Zehner, they point out that the Magi were heretical Zoroastrians. Mm. In fact, R.C. Zehner points out that they were devil-worshipping or deva-worshipping, demon-worshipping devas, the demon-worshipping Magi or Zoroastrians.
Kind of like the assassins in the Muslim world, in a sense.
The direct relationship to the assassins. So the Magi, I lost my point there. They were devil worshipping.
So you were talking. Sorry, and, I don't want to interfere in this.
Is proof in the Greek works, especially the works of Heraclitus. There's also papyrus that was discovered a few decades ago that specifically describes the Magi as being devil worship or demon worshippers, and as basically in worshippers of the infernal. Mm. And so this Magi cult then spread to various parts of the world. And the point that I am making is that, in my book, The Dying God, is that this cult obviously is not Zoroastrian. It's not Persian. When you look at it, it's the exact same set of beliefs that became the core of Kabbalah.
Mm.
So that is the worship of the planets, the identification of the four elements, the belief in reincarnation, so astrology, numerology, and also mixed with the worship of the dying god. So what's interesting basically is what seems to have happened is that these dying god, these Jews who used to worship the dying god before they came to Babylon, when they got to Babylon, they mixed that cult with magic. That's how Kabbalah came about. So what you find now is that beyond the 6th century, the Magi, especially, so the Persians conquer Babylon and they liberate the Jews, and the Jews get to go back to Palestine to rebuild the temple, but not all of them go back to Palestine. Some of them go to Greece, some of them go to Egypt, and specifically Alexandria, and that is where you find extensions of the Magi influence and where it develops. So that's why, so basically what happens is Plato and Pythagoras were influenced. Basically, they developed ideas of the Magi. I argue that Plato was a Kabbalist.
Mm.
He is regarded as a Kabbalist by leading Kabbalists throughout the centuries. According to several ancient Jewish scholars, Plato derived his teachings from the Jews. He is claimed that he traveled to Egypt to learn. It's claimed that Pythagoras traveled to Persia to learn amongst the Magi. So it's not a far-fetched theory. It's been supported over and over by various sources throughout history. So what happens is that so this Magi cult develops in Greece as Greek philosophy, and it develops in Egypt as what's called Hermeticism. And Hermeticism is a cult of alchemy that is based on the worship of the Egypt or the dying god, Egyptian dying god Hermes. Mm-hmm. And so out of Greek philosophy, you get Neoplatonism. And so now when the Jews are become active in Palestine in the third, second, first century BC, all these influences now come back. And that's where you get the birth of Kabbalah.
So I bet they don't teach you that at Oxford at the PPE course, Martin, for politics, philosophy and economics, in the middle bit, philosophy particularly.
Well, that is a version of ancient history. And he's mentioned quite a lot of things there. He mentions Zoroastrianism. He mentions Babylonian exile of the Jews. He talks about Plato. He mentions Pythagoras. And he's got a particular axe he's trying to grind there, which sounds very familiar to me, which is the idea that there is this ancient wisdom, or possibly evil wisdom, which runs through all of these things. Now, in actual fact, I read a lot of, not so much philosophy, but archaeology and history, and what he's doing there is he's basically stringing together lots of different things and drawing his conclusion from the things that he's strung together. But there's lots of other people who've got different views from that about the relationship between the things that he's talking about.
But isn't it a little bit like the City of London, that the people that really know what's going on, they're going to make sure that the universities and everyone else is not going to find it out?
Well, you've got the idea that there's some kind of esoteric knowledge and a small group of people who have that esoteric knowledge and everybody else who hasn't got it. That is there's quite a strong streak of esotericism in history. I mean, people believing themselves to have the knowledge that others haven't got. It's quite common, in fact, you know. And you could even see it in modern communism. You know, we are the elite that understand the laws of history, and the masses are going to be moved by our superior knowledge. What I'd say about all of these things is, yes, there are elites that try and control things. They do create kind of elite ideologies that they want, you know, in order to fulfill whatever goals they've got. But history carries on being messy, and all sorts of messy stuff happens, and it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen next.
I can't help but just raise the interesting spectre of the interview we did a few months ago with Philip Beale and his thing about the Phoenicians, because, you know, there you've got the possibility that they're involved in this spreading this kind of similar ideas about mathematics, geometry and that sort of thing around the world in ancient history. But what about this? I mean, what he's trying to do, I think, David Livingston, maybe he's failing, maybe he's succeeding, I quite like his attempt anyway, is to come up with a kind of unified theory of occultism and mysticism, where you've got the occult, which is this kind of secret societies and machinations behind the scenes, which are actually changing things, making things happen in a way a bit like, a James Bond film, you know, trying to change the course of history through the secret services or whatever. And then against that, you've got mysticism, which is the kind of myth making, pushing stuff out, information operations, pushing stories out, myths out through the mainstream press, a bit things like 9/11, things like, if you're going back even further, Prester John, the letter of Prester John, which was a way of trying to get everyone behind the Crusades, getting all these wealthy people to put all their money into the Crusades, thinking it was a great Christian thing to do. So do you think he's actually getting anywhere when he's trying to put this unified theory together?
I think the problem with all unified theories is that they're unified. And in actual fact, for example, we're only talking here about the Middle East. We could be talking about Southeast Asia, which has got a completely different mythological basis. And they've got esoteric beliefs in Southeast Asia, but they're not the same as esoteric beliefs in the Eastern
Mediterranean. Well, I'm sure he would say that there are indications of these philosophies in Hinduism, for example.
All right, well, some people claim, and it's not necessarily illogical, that all human beliefs are linked because there's a fundamental reality in which links all human beings together. That's an interesting idea, but the reality of life in general is that it's messy, and that what you usually find is you've got competing stories about what's happening, competing ideologies, competing ways of looking at the world, not just one. And in actual fact, they're all struggling with each other to push their particular version of events and of the way reality is constructed.
Anyway, David Livingstone's book is called The Dying God. Maybe I should email him, Martin, and see if he'll send you a copy, and maybe you will even read the first few pages of it. What do you think?
Well, I can look it up online if I was that interested. I read an awful lot about these things, but I tend to read the academic works rather than people who've got their...
But don't you think the truth is more around the fringes rather than at the heartlands of the universities?
No, I think that the people who do modern historical research, it's far superior to what was written even 10 or 15 years ago.
But the universities...
For example, we've now got access to DNA analysis, which really tells us who is related to who.
Yes,
and there's been lots of speculation about that. We now know who's related to who.
There's also a tremendous amount of faking of DNA, too.
Well, yeah, yeah, what you want, Tony, is you want everybody...
No, I'm saying, for example, the Martin Bormann skull that we've talked about quite a lot of times. They said, oh, yes, this is definitely his skull, and maybe it was his skull. But they were making all sorts of claims that they could, you know, but weren't necessarily justified. And these sorts of technologies are also open to abuse. They're a belief system. It's a little bit like he was talking there about these ancient civilizations. It's what you believe that counts, not what the facts are.
Well, indeed, and that's exactly the point. I mean, ultimately, it should be the facts that determines what we believe. But in actual fact, most people pick their facts to suit their original intentions.
And maybe that's just what you're doing, and maybe that's just what I'm doing.
Well, indeed.
Who knows? Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem councillor for Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Also to our Irish Republican Labour activist, Martin Summers, you just heard from, and to studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. I'm at Castle Park, 2 o'clock, here in Bristol on Sunday. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sunday evenings at 6. Danny Lopsch on BCFM is excellent. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday, where we'll be joined by 9/11 author Ian Henshaw to discuss similarities between the COVID op and 9/11. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.